Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here, and particularly to be speaking between two people, one of whom is one of the founders of New Resource Economics, and the other one of the founders of Free Market Environmentalism. Real pleasure. When Joe Morris was talking at lunch about some of those good folks in Arkansas, I was getting rather nervous. I was afraid that if he couldn't continue to talk, he might get down to South Georgia, where I hail from. Is there anyone else in here from South Georgia? I wouldn't want to embarrass anyone by my presentation. But it was probably one of my kinsmen some years ago that showed up at a college seeking admission from South Georgia. And the lady in the admissions office said, "Well, son, we're glad to see you. We don't see many people from South Georgia seeking higher education." She said, "I have some questions for you. First off, how old are you?" 18. And she said, "Well, that's fine. That's the right age. How many years of schooling have you had?" 12. That's good. And what's your first name?" "Thomas." She said, "Well, I understand how it is. Some of you folks from South Georgia have trouble with numbers and you count on your fingers. But what's with this?" And he said, "Oh, you know, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you." So I come equipped with all kinds of mnemonic devices. And as John Bodden put it so nicely, I come to you to talk about sludge. I'm one of those that's in the sludge part of this study of environmental policy. But my remarks link to the title of the session and perhaps go a little beyond it, but I want to talk briefly with you about paradoxes, leviathans, and America's coming golden age. First off, paradoxes. It seems to me that you and I live in a world that is shot full of, with it, well, I should say, at least two contrasting situations which pose for me a powerful paradox. On some days I feel as though I almost truly live in the Garden of Eden, which is to say I see resources available to me, plentiful resources. I see declining costs. I see access to resources that were not available 10 years ago. I see the ability to travel, to obtain information, on and on, in a greater way than ever in my lifetime. There we are, we talk about email, internet. Any one of us can get on the internet and find access not only to information, but to goods. We can select houses, we can purchase automobiles, we can search the market, we can engage in complex contracts for financial derivatives, we can even communicate with the IRS. There we have access. One of the most sophisticated, highly evolved market economies with friction removed from it that the world has ever known, based on the rule of law, based on the operations of markets, based on people who believe in rules of just conduct. There we have it. But the paradox is that at the same time, I might not best cut down a juniper tree on my property without first checking with the Corps of Engineers or with some federal authority to make certain that I am not violating some federal rule or law which might have to do with providing habitat for an endangered species. That if a grizzly bear comes on my property in the evening and poses a threat to me or appears to in my family, I best not rush out with a rifle in an attempt to defend my family from that grizzly bear. That if there is a flood of my river which floods my farmland, and when the floods recede, I seek to go back and plow that land again, I best check and get a permit from the Corps of Engineers, because it is quite possible that that land has turned into a wetland and I will no longer be able to farm it. I might be careful before putting a load of builder's sand on a lot in preparation for building a house, because if I do, I might suffer the fate of a man and his son who did that and ended up in the federal penitentiary in Atlanta for the violation of federal rules. That is to say, while I live in a world that is highly sophisticated with respect to the operation of markets, The availability of vast amounts of information in which I can almost freewheel with my transactions in one part of the world, in another part of my life, or in the life of my fellow citizens, we live as if in a feudal system on a manor where it is necessary for us to get permission of the manor lord before taking certain actions that might have to do with the environment and natural resources, and that is a powerful paradox. That is, we are using the crudest forms of allocation mechanisms for dealing with some of the most precious assets that we have, while we have available to us some of the most sophisticated mechanisms that human beings could ever conceive of. How on earth did this happen? In truth, of course, that sophisticated system based on markets and the rule of law and rules of just conduct had been evolving over the centuries through courts of common law and in other ways with traditions and customs where ordinary people figured out ways to conserve resources and to protect the environment as they saw it its needs to be protected. In truth, that system was evolving. Many people are not aware of that because many people are not old enough to be aware of it, or either have no reason to engage in the study of the history of common law and policy, environmental policy. There are many who believe it all began in 1970 when the US EPA was created. But those who probe back a little will find this rich heritage of the rule of law, where in this country we had river basin associations, we had multi-state compacts. Every state and every major city had systems to protect air quality. We had systems for protecting water quality, not as sophisticated as what might have emerged had they not been stopped by that Leviathan that changed things. And so how did it happen, and what might explain this shift of regimes which occurred in my and your lifetime? To answer that question, I want to go back and identify what I consider to be the first Leviathan that was baptized, and certainly not the one that Thomas Hobbes wrote about. I'm speaking of America's economic history. And that first Leviathan, I would suggest, is described in rather good terms by P.J. Hill and Terry Anderson in their book, The Birth of the Transfer Society. And we look back 100 years, almost precisely from the present, to find that first Leviathan that arises in the American economy, where the federal government begins to intervene in meaningful ways in regulating commerce and the economy. That first regulatory agency, the Interstate Commerce Commission, that arises in 1887, and then that first antitrust statute that is passed in 1890, sometimes we identify as benchmarks for the beginning. But as that Leviathan arose, which regulated particular industries, something it did not do was to erode the rule of law. It did not erode the protection of basic property rights. What we had was the rise of a Leviathan that was regulating particular sectors and particular industries, but not everything. As that Leviathan arose and expanded, we who have studied it and others have identified for us what appears to be a paradox, which ceased to be a paradox as economists began to develop theories of regulation. But it began to be noticed that it wasn't just the populace who were seeking this form of regulation. In many cases, it was the industry itself. Here was an opportunity to be cartelized by the federal government, where it was very difficult to run a cartel otherwise. Here was an opportunity to have the ICC set your rates for you and to avoid vicious competition from the entry and expansion of other modes of transportation, for example. But as time passed and technological change occurred, that cloak of protection provided by regulation began to feel like a hair shirt to some of those industries, which is to say regulation became obsolete. And so, as we look at this history, we see the decline of economic regulation, which begins to show up in the 1960s and then is accelerated in the 1970s, and we get deregulation. But all along, that second Leviathan is beginning to emerge, the baptism of the second Leviathan. I would suggest, occurs with what we consider to be the beginning of the environmental saga, or what some call the environmental revolution. And here we see something quite different from regulation of the past. Instead of the regulation of industries, one industry at a time, it is the regulation of functions across all industries. It's the regulation of processes. And whereas in the past, by and large, property rights were respected and constitutional constraints were very real, with this new Leviathan, property rights begin to mean very little, and constitutional constraints begin to seem as though they have evaporated. Bob Higgs has written a marvelous book. I hope you've read it. If you have a chance, put it on your reading list, and it's certainly not new, Crisis and Leviathan, in which he describes the reaction of a democratic government, a representative government, to crises that emerge, and how following a particular crisis, government addressing that crisis looms large but never shrinks back completely. And you get a ratcheting of the growth of this public sector agent, this Leviathan, one problem at a time. When we look at the environmental saga, we can pick out Love Canal as a misguided basis for Superfund. Here we have a national emergency which has nothing whatsoever to do with what Superfund alleges to be about, but it becomes the basis for passage of legislation where it was impossible to get majorities otherwise. We have Bhopal in India, and shortly thereafter we get the toxics release inventory requirements put out by EPA, which requires industry to provide data on better than 600 chemicals in pounds annually for the emissions, even though the emissions themselves are not rated and listed by toxicity. We get global warming. We get acid rain. And we get legislation based on these crises, and in a sense, the Leviathan looms larger. Well, what explains this? With such a wonderful title as Leviathan Rebaptized, how can I resist making reference to bootleggers and Baptists? Because this was supposed to have some religious content in it, was it not, Danny? What explains this? That is, we can look at this rise of the Leviathan and sometimes the shrinkage of it and then the rebaptism of the Leviathan, but what explains its durability? Why is it that we can have a statute where most every thoughtful person says it makes no sense, which is to say the Superfund law, yet it is impossible to get movement through Congress to revise or repeal that law? Why is it that we have this kind of gridlock? Well, let me suggest to you that thinking about bootleggers and Baptists may help us. In my region of the country, in the Southeast, there's a rich tradition of bootleggers. There are a lot of people, as my grandfather said, are bad to drink, but in many cases they live in dry counties or in areas where one may not purchase alcoholic beverages other than under strict circumstances. And so the bootlegger buys it on the days when it can be sold legally and sells it at a higher price on the days when it is illegal to sell alcoholic beverages. They engage in arbitrage. They buy where it's cheap and sell where it's high, and they do their best to satisfy the desires and yearnings for people for demon rum. Then there are good Baptists, and good Baptists are in favor of a diminution of the consumption of alcoholic beverages, and their dream is to have a society in its purest sense where there would be no production, let alone consumption, of alcoholic beverages. Now, the legislature, in its wisdom, seeks to satisfy the needs of the people, and so they will pass statutes which shut down the liquor stores on Sunday, or in other ways limit the sale of alcoholic beverages in particular forms and times, shutting the stores on. On a neighbor as a result of pollution, and that neighbor showed scientific evidence, then the controversy before the court could be settled and the judge might shut the polluter down. Would never say, go get a permit, and if you have a permit, it's okay to impose cost on your neighbor. not at common law. And so an industry could never cartelize itself through a property rights market common law system, but it can through statutes. The marvelous thing about these statutes is generally they have stricter requirements for new sources and new plants than for older plants. And so you limit entry and gain the opportunity to see an increase in the price of your wares, and then the EPA stands at the gate to limit the entry of new competition. And there we have it. Out of Kyoto and the concern about global warming, 1 week after that conference, indeed in a matter of days, farmers and producers of corn products were lobbying Congress saying, remember ethanol, it's clean. And very shortly thereafter, this Congress and the Finance Committee and so forth continued a powerful subsidy for the production of ethanol in the United States in the spirit of reducing carbon emissions. The spokesman from two major world petroleum companies were quoted 1 week later saying, we want to experiment with this plan for permit trading and the reduction of carbon because we have made major investments in alternative energy sources and we are also large natural gas producers. In other words, if you can do the coal industry, if you can knock them in the head or in other ways raise the cost of your competitors by means of this process, then you will join with the environmentalists in singing their song. When we look at other features of environmental protection, we should look for differential effects and the opportunities for special interest groups to gain, and I'm not speaking just about environmental groups, but others who gain as well, which suggests to me that we have a very durable Leviathan on our hands. Well, what on earth might make it go away? I've talked about Leviathans, and I've talked about paradoxes, and now let's talk about America's coming golden age, and can we get there? 100 years ago, there were three major forces playing through our economy that are playing through our economy today. One, a huge wave of immigration. If you look at the data, we are having waves of immigrants now that compare only with what was happening at the turn of the century. People seeking opportunities to better themselves, putting competitive pressures in labor markets, keeping wages down, leading to deflationary forces in our economy 100 years ago. We've got the same thing now. 100 years ago, there was a technological revolution occurring in this country. If you look at the number of patents being issued by year, you see something that looks a lot like what's going on now in our economy. And 100 years ago, if you look at mergers, acquisitions, and restructurings of corporations weighted by GDP, you will see a larger wave of mergers and restructurings 100 years ago than today. What followed that period 100 years ago is referred to as America's golden age, a time when well-being increased at a pace unknown up until that time. These forces are playing through our economy again, but we've got something in the way. The second Leviathan. I think my grandchildren have bright prospects for living in America's second golden age, but it will only come if the forces of competition, global and otherwise, condition this Leviathan and limit its capabilities, and if we find ways to promote the notions of markets, property rights, and the rule of law. The largest threat, I think, that is on the horizon has to do with efforts to cartelize every nation on the globe through such things as Kyoto. My mother loved me a lot when I was little. I'm an eternal optimist. I believe the golden age is coming, but it needs your help. Thanks so much for your kind attention.